If you could all please take your seats and go ahead and fill in all of the seats. It will be standing room only, I believe. There were a lot of you that wanted to be here today, and I'm grateful to have all of you here. I'll just say a welcome, and then I'm going to queue up a video, and I'll come back and introduce Tom. Welcome to the White House. It is wonderful to have you all here. My name is Andrew Coy, and as you have guessed at this point, I imagine, I am a real person. And I really did email all of you, and I really did try to find as many people as I could around this country that run makerspaces to bring you all here today. So let's watch a quick little video to cue up some remarks from Tom, and I'll come back and introduce him after the video.
Thank you.
Okay, now that everyone is seen that and we're getting started here, again, let me welcome you to the White House and say that it's an incredible honor to serve here in the capacity of senior advisor for Making. But the only reason that I am here and that all of us are here is actually because of Tom Khalil. And Tom has a long history of supporting innovation, research, entrepreneurship, the maker movement. He served under President Clinton and then helped be responsible for bringing internet to the people. He saw it in the early days before it was out there and said, this is going to change things. And if you remember net days, if you remember some of that wire pulling to get things spread throughout the country, Tom was behind helping that here at the White House. And in addition to that, he's also served in roles with the Clinton Global Initiative. He served as a special advisor special assistant to the Chancellor for Science and Technology at UC Berkeley. Like I said, at the Clinton Global Initiative, he was the chair of the Global Health Working Group. He also has served in capacities supporting the Semiconductor Industry Association with U.S. Japan trade issues and technology policy. His behind the scenes and sometimes out in front, where you actually get to hear what he has to say and think, has been an incredible inspiration to so many. And he was named even most interesting man in Washington. But all of that to say that Tom is the reason we are all here, and it is my honor to welcome him to the stage for a few remarks about the Maker Movement. Thank you, Tom, for being here.
Thank you, Andrew, for that overly kind introduction. My father would have been proud, and my mother would have believed it. Is everyone fired up and ready to go?
Yeah.
All right. So Andrew was telling me that he was sending out emails inviting people, and everyone was like, is this a joke? What I wanted to do, first of all, please join me in thanking Andrew for his tireless work on behalf of the Maker Movement. He has done a fantastic job. But I just wanted to tell you a little bit about why this has become a priority for President Obama, and then also why I think we should take the phrase Maker Movement literally, as opposed to it just being a figure of speech, and tell you what I think that could mean for the future of the Maker Movement. So in terms of why this is something that got on President Obama's radar screen and why he decided to have a 18-foot robotic giraffe from Burning Man on the south lawn of the White House when we did the 2014 Maker Fair, I would say that there are four reasons. The first reason is that making advances values that are ends in themselves. So whether it's curiosity or tinkering or teamwork or self-efficacy, and creative confidence, these are all things that are worthwhile of themselves. The second reason is that he has a real interest in getting more young people to get excited about STEM and advanced manufacturing and design. And one of the problems that we have in education is that students get bored. A lot of them check out as they go from primary to middle to high school. And they don't understand what the relevance of what they're learning is, and just being told, oh, it's going to be on the test, that's why, is not a terribly compelling reason for a lot of people to learn these. So that if they understand what the connections are between something that they're interested in, something that they find intrinsically motivating, then they're going to work a lot harder, and they're going to do better in whether they decide to go on to a career or pursue college. This is something that can get more young people interested and really see the relevance of this. And Carl Bass, who's the CEO of Autodesk, calls this just in time as opposed to just in case, So just in case, you know, you're learning trigonometry because maybe 5 years from now you're going to have to use trigonometry, just in time is there's some problem that you're super excited about solving, and there's something that you're going to learn right away that is going to allow you to solve that problem. So that's the second reason that we're excited about this. The third reason has to do with innovation and entrepreneurship and the revitalization of American manufacturing. And we've got a number of the leaders from the Small Business Administration and the Department of Commerce who are here who help drive our agenda on innovation and entrepreneurship. And one of the reasons that there is so much innovation in the digital world is that the cost of doing a startup has plummeted. It used to be that if you wanted to do a startup, you would have to raise millions of dollars and go out and buy a bunch of expensive servers and pay for a lot of licenses. Now, because of things like open source software and the cloud, a startup may be several people living on ramen noodles for several months. And developing a minimum viable product of their idea, and then being able to get very early feedback from customers about whether they've created something that people want. So whenever you lower the barriers to entry to something, whenever you make something less expensive and easier, people will do more of it. And so the question is whether the maker movement provides that opportunity not only in the digital world, but in the physical world and in the growing convergence between the digital and the physical world. So in some cities, for the cost of a gym membership, you can get access to $1 million worth of machine tools and the training needed to use computer numerically controlled machine tools and laser cutters and 3D printers and something that can cut through 3 inches of steel. And so if you have an idea, you can develop a prototype for that and then perhaps use crowdfunding in order to be able to mobilize the resources that you need to launch that. So that's another reason, is that it's lowering the barriers to entry in the physical world in the same way that arguably the internet and cloud computing and open source software have done so in the digital world. And finally, as you saw from that great video, which is a makeathon that was organized by an Israeli nonprofit organization called Tikkun Olam Maker, which is Hebrew for Makers Repairing the World. It was a collaboration between makers and people with disabilities who were co-designing solutions that people with disabilities face, like, you know, being able to open up a door or get in and out of a wheelchair. And so I think the fourth reason is that the maker movement increases the number of problem solvers. It increases the number of people who can look at a problem like that of improving the quality of life for people with disabilities or building a more sustainable economy or getting more young people excited about STEM and design and advanced manufacturing and have the skills and the creative confidence to co-design solutions to those challenges that we face. So those are the reasons why we think this is so important and why this is something that the president has been promoting. The last thing I want to talk about is the role, this taking the notion of the maker movement literally as opposed to it just being a figure of speech. And if you think about what it is that movements do, they have a goal. So, you know, if the environmental movement is interested in how do we preserve the environment for future generations? How do we have an economy that grows and creates jobs, but do so in a way that, reduces greenhouse gases, for example? And I think that an example of a goal that the maker movement could rally behind is, how do we make these types of experiences available for more people, and you know, particularly for young people? So that's one thing that movements have, is that they have a goal. And the second thing is that they have some lightweight infrastructure for increasing the number of individuals and organizations that get involved. So, you know, if you think about this, the question of how would we make this available for more young people, you would want to have spaces in schools and after-school programs. You would want to have tools and materials. You'd want to have mentors that can help students work on progressively more challenging projects. And that's not something that any one individual or organization could do, but I really believe that at the local and regional level, that people could expand the number of individuals and organizations that are participating, that are providing financial or in-kind support or lending their expertise or being a mentor to a teacher or a student. So that's what I would like you to think about, not only today, but when you go back to your community, is how do you take this phrase, the maker movement, and increase the number of people that are involved, whether it's the leadership of schools and after-school programs. You know, you shouldn't take it for granted that they've ever heard of this or necessarily understand why it is potentially related to education and lifelong learning and workforce development. How do we get more foundations and libraries and museums? One of the things that is in the packet that Andrew put together is a number of commitments that different types of organizations have made. So for example, a number of universities have said, we're going to promote this on our campus. So Case Western Reserve University is investing in a 50,000 square foot facility that will have coffee on the ground floor, design, prototyping, and fabrication space on the middle floors, and an accelerator on the top floor. MIT has decided that if you want to apply to MIT, one of your options is now to submit your maker portfolio. A number of mayors have agreed to take the Mayor's Maker Challenge to promote making at the local level. So I really believe that there is a broad coalition that is increasingly seeing both how they can both benefit from and contribute to this effort. And I hope when you return to your cities and towns and communities that you'll stay in touch with us, that you'll let us know how we can help, and that you will work in your own community to expand the number of people and organizations that is excited about this, is aware of it, and is taking concrete steps to expand the number of people, young and old, that have an opportunity to participate. So have a great day, and I'm really looking forward to the awesome ideas that I know you're going to come up with to take the maker movement to the next level. So no pressure. Take care.
So the way today is going to be organized, you'll see, is we're having a few talks and individuals speak down here in the South Core Auditorium, and then we're going to move upstairs for lunch and then breakout workshops. So to kick us off, I wanted to invite a few folks to just give insights into their journeys and their experiences in creating makerspaces, in creating these opportunities, in creating programs. So without further ado, I'll turn it over to Emily Pilloton from Project H to tell about her experiences. In short, these are quick 5-minute lightning presentations. And there's a clicker up here for you.
Okay, good morning. Yay. I had no idea I was going to go first, so I'm very nervous and hope I can set a good tone. My name is Emily Pilloton. I'm the founder of a nonprofit called Project H Design. We're 8.5 years old. I'm a former recovering architect. I quit my job as an architect at age 26 in 2008 because I was sick of designing plumbing fixtures for people that I didn't really care much about. And I really wanted to get back to architecture as this this way of making space and making meaning and contributing to a community and actually building stuff with my hands. So that was the frustration with which I founded this organization. It's been 8 years. Specifically, we work with young people and teach design and building, and we build actual architecture with young people. We've had 800 young folks who've come through our programs. We've built 30 8 projects, and about 90,000 people have interacted with our organization and the projects that we've built. But this fascination with space, and this is what I want to talk about briefly this morning, is the importance of making and making space. So this is a blueprint. I drew this when I was in architecture school for my parents on their 25th anniversary. This is a blueprint of my childhood home, and there are no actual blueprints, so I did this from memory. We didn't live there anymore, and I made some notations, and as I was making these notations, I was noticing, like, the things I was marking in this space were actually stories, not so much, oh, here's where the whatever, the cabinet or the living room, or they were things like, this is where the Christmas tree went, and this is where I played Foursquare with my sisters. So the idea that space is where we physically hold our stories is really important to me, and I think one of the reasons I became an architect. So fast forward, one of our programs is called Studio H, and it's a high school program. This is our classroom. It's a organized, chaotic mess. We design and build all kinds of things, from dog houses to actual houses to our own classroom spaces. So this is a space that we have created for stories and for community, and also a space in which students can create other spaces. So some of the projects that our students have built, this space is in Berkeley, California, but we've done projects in other communities as well. This is a farmer's market that was designed and built by 17-year-olds. And it created 4 new businesses and 15 new jobs in a town of 1,500 people. This is the school library that the students identified as, like, why don't we have a library? We need a space to discover and to learn and find things that we didn't know we were looking for. So we designed and built our own school library. So I love the idea that we can make spaces and nurture young people who then will go and make more spaces to increase and expand and strengthen our communities. Over the course of teaching the Studio H program, I had this very special relationship with some of my female students, and without going into a whole long monologue about gender in architecture and design and building, I think we all know that there are some spaces in which girls don't feel welcome, in which they don't feel included, and so I wanted to create a girls-only space in which girls could be audacious and brave and do all the things they're incredibly talented at. And so this is the girls program that grew out of some of the observations that I had in our program and also experiences that I've had in my life. I also, if anyone's read this book, Sandra Cisneros is one of my favorite authors. She wrote this book that came out last year called A House of My Own, and she talks so poignantly, and better than I am right now, about the importance of space and of creating spaces for creativity and for safety and for imagination. She describes her own home that she's made for herself as a fortress for the creative self, and that a house all your own would mean a place to imagine and be safe. So with this girls program, I also felt it was important to have a space of our own outside of the classroom that we were sharing with the other program. So in 2 weeks, I've been working all summer on opening this other space. It's a 3,600 square foot space, only for young girls that are ages 9 to 17. It's 4 walls, it's ours, and we get to make it whatever we want. I could also talk a lot about safety and organization. I'm sure we'll get into that later, but I want to say also that I think the beauty of space is that in creating a space, we get to also create the structures and the culture that live within it. So this is our tool wall. We, the female instructors, built this together with some of the girls. We believe deeply that creating limits increases creativity, and that creating structure gives, especially young people, the safety to feel like they can take calculated risks and succeed. We also believe that spaces that are dignified and beautiful and well-organized and safe create more pathways, and we can say, okay, this is a space where you can go from here to here, and we will make sure that you get there. And then, this is a very literal thing, we believe in putting our names on the wall. And so this is our donor/participant wall. We want every girl that walks into our space to know that their name is on the wall and that they are a part of the community and that they're reclaiming a space that has traditionally not been all that accessible to them. And then lastly, the thing I want to leave us with is this idea that when we create new spaces for making and for young people, that we also have the responsibility to expand our community and to do things that live in the community. So this is Amber and Ella. They are two girls that are in our program. One of them lives in the local women's shelter with her mother, and the other is recovering from leukemia, and they are new best friends. And they're building a bookshelf that now lives in the women's shelter. So we can come together, we can build things, and we can also build those things for things beyond our four walls. So that's it. I want to say that I'm so excited to be in a room with people who are doing and struggling with the exact same things that I am. I believe so deeply in the power of making, and that space is the place in which we tell stories, where we build community, and where we can also give voice and power back to certain individuals that have not previously had it. So this is our tagline, Fear Less, Build More. And I think that's something we can all take into our spaces back in our home communities. Thank you so much.
Morning, everyone. Thanks, Emily. Thanks, Andrew, for having me today. My name is Will Holman, and unlike all of you, I do not have a makerspace yet. I see a lot of people in the audience that have been very helpful to me over the last 3 years over this development timeline of OpenWorks. So I'm here to share with you our project, which opens 1 month from today. If I can get the clicker to work. Okay. One more. So we are a 34,000 square foot makerspace nonprofit community facing in central Baltimore. We've been under development for the last 3 years. Next. So we sit at the core of four very disinvested neighborhoods that have suffered from 50 years of segregation, redlining, gutting of public education, and rampant speculation in property and other things. The populations here are undereducated, under and unemployed, and live in the midst of vacant housing stock. So we're trying to build this space as a flexible factory where people can very concretely improve their lives. A lot of the maker movement is very much focused on robots and STEM education and all these things, and there's nothing wrong with that. That's wonderful, and we want to be a platform to serve that, but also to really serve Baltimore and serve our neighbors, we need to be a little more than that. So these are our core facilities. You're all familiar with most of these. So downstairs, we clustered our heavy shops. We're right on the Amtrak line, so if any of you took the train down here, you probably passed right by us. So we have wood, our CNC and laser cutting shop, and our metal shop. And then we borrowed some ideas from a lot of labs across the country, including our friends up at Artisans Asylum. So we've included 70 micro studios on each floor, which are 50 square foot spaces that people can use. We're very privileged to have enough square footage to kind of devote to this workspace. Upstairs, we have another 70 of the micro studios. And then we have our quote-unquote clean studios, textiles, electronics, 3D printing, and digital media. Then we have two classrooms, a computer lab, lobby retail, and a cafe. We're launching a farmer's market in our parking lot in October. We sit in a food desert, so the cafe and the farmer's market are all parts of both building our audience for our space, but also reaching out to our community and seeing what needs we can fill for folks. So we've been chronicling our build on Make Magazine. We have a blog over there called Made in Baltimore. It's up every 2 weeks. The latest post went up at the top of this week about our staff. But I think one of the interesting things about that I can add to this group, since I don't have an operational space yet, is our kind of innovation in the financing piece. We were built by a nonprofit development company called the Baltimore Arts Realty Corporation that was able to leverage public money from the state and from a federal instrument called New Market Tax Credits, and bring that together with philanthropic funds from local foundations and low-cost debt from CDC. And so we kind of stirred that all in a pot and came up with the money to build this space. That serves as a baked-in subsidy that then allows us to keep our prices low. So again, we are a nonprofit. We're kind of like a YMCA. We'll subsist mostly on user fees with some grant subsidy. So affordability to us starts at $70 a month for the clean studios. The downstairs heavy studios will be $90 a month, and the top rate will be $125. We're also offering some scholarship memberships and some work-study memberships for folks that find that too expensive. But as a point of comparison, we tried to make the entry level is the same as a Y family membership. So that's kind of in people's wheelhouse and in the realm of a comfortable monthly expense. Education, our youth and family stuff is completely subsidized by grants through the end of this year. So we're launching a schedule October through December. And then as we slide into the new year, we'll move to a sliding scale structure. So those that can afford to pay can subsidize those that can't. We're still working on some workforce development initiatives. So that's pretty much our space. I'm really here to learn today. And please stay in touch. I'd love to hear from all of you and see what your challenges are and try to learn how to grow our space equitably and effectively. So thank you so much.
Hi, everyone. My name's Sean. I'm from AS220, which is a community arts center, and we are in downtown Providence. Lots of rats and pigeons. We can go to the next. So when Andrew, when we were talking, he asked if we had any kind of best practices or advice to share, and I said that, you know, to what we found is, you know, to be a successful creative community organization, you really have to you have to do all of it. And what do we mean by all of it? Well, I've kind of come up with a model. We can go to the next one, actually, called the AS20 Stack, which stack is kind of a software engineering term. Generally, you know, so this is basically all of it. It's kind of in its special order. You know, generally the bottom is kind of closer to the hardware, or you know, kind of foundational. Things on the top kind of have more dependencies to the things on the bottom. And so if there was a book of AS20 best practices, this could be the table of contents. But I'll also use it just to show you some pictures as a structure here. So at the very bottom of the stack, we have artifacts, which is your documentation, and it's the actual work that's created. And you know, so this is the stuff that lives on kind of on a 100-year time frame, and it kind of feeds the rest of the stack. Next up is you know, people, obviously. So it's not just, you know, membership management, volunteer management, governance, but you know, also trickier things like, you know, creating the right culture. Next, you know, we have to sort of tend networks of people. The way that we're most connected to the international community is through the Fab Academy, which is a class we've run for the past 7 years. And actually, we just started just this morning. Actually, as we speak, we're starting a new class called How to Grow Almost Anything. We're participating in that. That's all about synthetic biology. And kind of another network that we've been experimenting with is sort of like small research groups. So we have a group called Print and Book Workshop, which is all about bookmaking. Kind of next up the stack is what I call Ballyhoo, which is kind of getting the word out, getting people excited about things. Kind of at its worst, at its best, it's storytelling, and at its worst, it's hype and everything in between. Resource raising, not just cash, but you know, obviously cash also. We've done some crowdfunding. We found that any crowdfunding we've done also kind of has to have a real world component too. Space, we've developed three different buildings in downtown Providence, and there are a couple more that are underway. But of course, you know, you don't have to own or, you know, develop your own building. We've actually done stuff in parking spaces also. And this is our fab lab print shop, what we call the AS20 Industries. It's kind of on a little secret alleyway off the back of one of our buildings. Equipment and materials. Materials is kind of I always think that there should be kind of a recycling center kind of on either side of the fab lab. Next. And technical support is, you know, finding the tools are kind of usually easy to find, but finding the people to support them is kind of the trickier part, but essential. And moving up the stack, food and drink is an important component. We run our own restaurant and bar, and there's also kind of the power of pizza. Workshops and mentoring, this is mostly the kind of the purview of our youth studio, but also the ACE 20 industries. Cottage industries, a lot of artists are kind of cobbled together living, you know, by a lot of different revenue sources, and we support that. And kind of the biggest, we can go to the next. The biggest cottage industry we have, just this year we merged with a little electronics kit business called Modern Device, so we kind of brought that into our lab, and now AS20 runs this online business that brings in a few $100,000 a year and helps subsidize the program. Next. The Open Forum, we have a performance space, gallery space, and any Rhode Island artist will get a chance to show or perform there. Product development is everything from we do murals, bus stops, radio shows, and then also we can go to the next. We also develop actual electronic gizmos. This is a little reverb effects pedal that will be coming out in a couple weeks from Modern Device. But and towards the top, research. I feel like this is something we should do more of, and I feel like the kind of hackerspace, makerspace network is actually can do meaningful research. We're still a little, this is a wind tunnel that we use to test our wind sensors. And kind of at the top of the stack is this idea of residency. So we have about over 50 artists who kind of live and work in the space. And then we bring other artists in to supplement that. So anyway, so that's the AS20 stack. I'm happy to talk more about that. And these are our all these slides will be posted on the industries.as20 website a little bit later.